This is 1A. I'm Jen White in Washington. This past spring, students, teachers, and parents were all thrown into the world of virtual learning. A new world means new rules, and K-12 schools across the country have been cracking down on rule breakers in both in-person and virtual classrooms. Education advocates warn that suspending students during a pandemic will widen an already large achievement gap, especially for those with learning differences. How do you keep order and keep students safe, but also leave room for compromise in some extremely uncompromising times? With us now is Carol O'Neill and her son Luke, a high schooler in Rockville, Maryland. Carol, Luke, welcome. Also with us is Danielle Elliott. Her 12-year-old son, Isaiah, made headlines last month when he was suspended for having a Nerf gun during his virtual class. They live in Colorado Springs. Danielle, thanks for joining us.
Hi, ma'am. Thank you for having me.
So, Danielle, I'm going to come to you first. Explain what happened with your son.
Yes, ma'am. So on the third day of virtual learning, we're still trying to navigate and learn how everything works. As you mentioned, you know, it's a hard time with the pandemic trying to adjust. And I received an email from my son Isaiah's art teacher saying that he had a hard time staying distracted, and he waved what appeared to be a toy gun, in her words, what she assumed to be a toy gun. Immediately, I respond to that email and I assure her that it was, in fact, just a toy. However, that I would talk to Isaiah about his behavior. About 3 hours later, I receive a phone call from the vice principal telling me that the cops are on their way to the house and that Isaiah would be suspended for 5 days. About an hour later, the police finally show up and they threaten to press charges for disruption of an educational institution, even though they saw it was just a toy. And then following that, a body cam footage was released, which showed the administrators and the two deputies that arrived at the school laughing and making jokes about pulling the trigger and different things like that. You also see in that body cam footage that they knew it was, in fact, just a toy. So for them to go as extreme as suspending him for 5 days and sending police to the house when they, in fact, did know it was just a toy, is very concerning. You know, it's an overreach of school jurisdiction. It's an invasion of privacy. It's a gross overreach and utilization of law enforcement in a school environment. And the bigger concerning issue here for me was, what if it had been a real gun? Is that the school's policy to wait over 4.5 hours to dispatch police if you truly thought it was a real gun and to get caught on body cam footage laughing about the matter? So it was a very upsetting situation. Definitely think it should have been handled a lot differently. And there's really not even words.
Carol, you left a message through our 1A text club about Luke having trouble with some rules in the virtual classroom. Tell us how what happened and how you handled it with the school.
So in Luke's case, when he's on Zoom, they take attendance, and for part of every class, he is required to put on a mask while he is on Zoom. Luke, who has special needs and difficulty communicating verbally, refuses to wear the mask. When he is out and about, he knows how to wear his mask. He does it on a regular basis. And for some reason, after 7 months of this pandemic, they feel the need, the teachers say, it's a practical application of following rules. And in his mind, he's a 12th grader, even though he has special needs, and he's ready to graduate, and he wants to be treated like every other child. Why in the world would they have them wearing masks at home over Zoom?
Luke, how did it make you feel to be disciplined for this?
It's just boring.
The class
boring
is,
and it,
the
yeah,
class
and
is
it
boring.
Take a long time for having... for putting on time.
It takes a long time for each. They wait until every child puts on their mask before they continue on with any of the learning. So it takes like 10, 15 minutes. And now they don't do it for the whole class. But by the time that's finished, it's taken quite a bit of education time away. And now they're extending the times and wanting them to wear them even longer during their Zoom calls.
Carol, how have you talk to the school about this or try to deal with this?
So we've reached out both to the teacher and to the supervisor of the special needs class in Luke's school. And they haven't come back to us, but the teacher just says that Luke refuses to wear the mask. And what Luke ends up doing is he just turns off his video so they can't see him. But he's actually started to not even want to be in any of the classes because of this. So it's turned into a real problem. We're trying to work with the school right now. I've talked to other people and in other special needs classes, even his last year class. Nobody else is doing this. It seems to be only his class.
Danielle, you also have students with learning differences. How much harder has it been, you think, for teachers to identify when students aren't engaged or may need some redirection?
I definitely think it's obviously a lot more difficult for teachers to engage with special needs students through the video visit, but that doesn't excuse the fact that our kids are still required by law to receive special accommodations and just, you know, as human decency, just some type of sympathy. You know, my son, he does struggle with ADHD. He does get distracted very easily. So in my particular situation, I would think that it would almost be easier when my child gets distracted or if he's distracted in the class to just hit the mute button, you know? Hit the mute button. Hey, Isaiah, disable your camera. Turn the mute button off. You're being very distracting. And I would almost think it would be easier. So, yeah, I'm at a loss of words for that other story.
I would love to hear from both of you about what advice you'd give to parents who might be going through the same thing as you. Because at a time when we're doing everything virtually, I would imagine it's even more difficult to advocate for your child. Carol?
Yeah, so again, communication with the teacher is key. But what I would suggest for, like your other guest mentioned, is there should be some kind of protocols in place. If the student is disruptive in some ways, what is, you know, best practices to try to get them back on board? Is it to hit the mute button? Or is it to have maybe smaller classes? In Luke's case, they're having, when they do these mask wearing, they're in a class of at least 20 kids with 7 adults. It seems if there's a smaller class, it's going to be a lot better. They don't have to spend as much time preparing them and all of that. But I think it's key to reach out to the school and keep in touch and let them know, the teachers know, because I know they're doing their best jobs that they can. But for Luke's case, with this whole mask, it's really put a stumbling block into his wanting to learn from these teachers.
Danielle, what about you? What advice would you have for parents?
I would definitely agree with some of the things that Carol stated. There needs to be clear-cut guidance outside of the brick-and-mortar school. You know, there has to be e-learning policies developed so that parents have an expectation. And so there's a expectation, a standard set across the board. For our particular situation, how do they enforce a policy that has yet to be written? They stated that Isaiah brought a facsimile of a gun to school, and that was his reason for a 5-day suspension. However, he was in the privacy of his own home playing with an airsoft gun that was orange and green, and it said Zombie Hunter on it. So for me, it's like, how can you enforce a policy that has yet to be written? And I definitely think these things need to be considered. And in the beginning of the year, I understand the pandemic hit the nation and it was very unpredictable. So teachers were scrambling, administrators, to try to figure out, you know, what to do next. But here in August, the third day of school, they had ample time to at least consider the needs of our special needs students. You know, my son the administration never once reached out to say, hey, how can we help Isaiah with his ADHD? Or, hey, here's special accommodations. Here's a specific classroom he can go to for additional help or anything like that. And in fact, when they suspended him, what that looks like in a virtual learning environment, again, on day 3, is Isaiah is not to log on to any of the virtual classrooms, therefore depriving him of his education and therefore depriving him of access to his teacher and the classmates to receive instruction. And instead, they sent him home with a 19-page packet in which my husband and I were, had to teach him on day 3.
Well, you're working with representatives from your state to create a bill in your son's honor. Tell us what it is and what you're hoping to accomplish.
Yes, ma'am. So we are hoping to hopefully introduce this bill in January that, again, would differentiate that policy for e-learning. One of the main issues I had in my particular case was The school never had parental consent to record my child in the privacy of his own home, let alone share that with outside entities. So for part of this bill would be to ensure parental consent on any recording. It would differentiate policy between e-learning expectations versus in-classroom instruction. And it would also speak to the overreach of jurisdictions. What are teachers allowed to do when students are in the privacy of their own home? And I think part of that would definitely help in Ms. Carroll's case, as far as how can a teacher tell your student what to wear in the privacy of their own home? The purpose of a mask is to, you know, prevent the spread of a virus, but who is her son, you know, putting at risk by not wearing a mask in his own home by himself? You know, that to me just blows my mind. Hmm.
Really quickly, Carol, what would you say to teachers who may be following a set of rules, likely that they didn't write, and are told they need to enforce them as part of their jobs? Is this about communication with parents as well?
Yeah, I definitely, that is the case. With Luke, again, in his IEP, he struggles with communication. So wearing the mask, not only, like you said, he's in his own home. So he knows in his mind that he doesn't have to wear this mask. But in his mind, he's like, he turns himself off. He's like, I can't, first of all, communicate. It's uncomfortable. They have reached out and suggested, you know, making wearing a mask bracket to make it more comfortable. I'm not sure what that is. But with the teachers, I understand they have, I'm not sure, because this particular teacher, it doesn't sound like anybody else in the school is doing this, feels a need that, you know, maybe towards his independent living goals, that he's going to eventually have to wear this. And again, in Montgomery County, I don't know if they'll even be going back to school. So I know they need to practice, but it really is something that, that the parents just need to keep in touch with the schools. I think,
That's Carol and Luke O'Neill. Luke is a high schooler in Rockville, Maryland, and he joined us with his mother, Carol. Also with us, Danielle Elliott, the mother of Isaiah Elliott, who has his first day at his new school today and couldn't join us. Luke, Carol O'Neill, Danielle, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Oh, we got this tweet from one of you who says, I want to cry hearing these parents' stories about virtual school special needs kids. Solidarity with the parents. The mask over Zoom story is unbelievable. I'm speechless. Another parent who's a member of our text club says, a teacher has gotten onto my son for eating on camera. I'm working from home. He eats when I can feed him. Not sorry. And then a text from a teacher listening who says, I've had to remove a student from a virtual lesson for not following guidelines of raising hands and waiting to be called on before unmuting and answering a question. Lots of grace was given through many reminders, explanations, and patience. We had to develop a 3-strike system. First 2 times is a warning. The 3rd time, the child is removed from the lesson. So let's get a look at the educator side of things. Ricky Gibbs is the principal of Warner Arts Magnet Elementary, a public school in Nashville, Tennessee. Principal Gibbs, it's a pleasure to have you with us.
Thank you for having me.
Also with us, Rachel Silberstein, an education reporter covering New York State for the Times Union. Rachel, thanks for being here.
Good to be here.
So, Rachel, before we get into deep, why is this a problem? I imagine some people saying, well, look, if a kid acts out and they get punished, tough stuff. So why is this question of disciplining kids a bigger issue than just, you know, something that hurt the kid or the parents' feelings?
I think Danielle and Carol are exactly right. There's just broad inconsistencies between various school districts and school systems in terms of what the expectations are in the virtual classroom. And the other issue is that teachers have sort of varying levels of technological savviness. And so I think a lot of the issues of disruption in the virtual classroom we found can be solved by just becoming better at using the controls that are available for Google Classroom and Zoom and platforms like that. Teachers can mute students, they can allow students in, they can decide when the class starts and ends. I know, you know, in our area, there are many teachers that struggled with, you know, students congregating or popping into each other's Zoom classes. And that's something that, you know, with time, I think teachers will get better at.
Mm-hmm. Principal Gibbs, what are the rules of conduct in the virtual setting at Warner Arts Magnet?
So when we're thinking about the virtual setting, we try to just leave everything through expectations. We expect that students are going to have the camera on, sitting up, and with the basics of you leave your computer on mute unless you're responding to a classmate or responding to your teacher, just so we can cut out most of the background noise.
How different or how big of an adjustment has this been for the teachers and the kids at your school?
It's been quite an adjustment, obviously, when you're used to your whole life being in person. So when you go to the virtual setting, it just creates a different dynamics. But we've been purposeful about making sure that we're taking all of the mindfulness and trauma-informed strategies that we use in person to the virtual setting to try to ease that transition.
Explain a little bit more about that, the trauma-informed approach you take at your school.
So we have a partnership with the local nonprofit Be Well in School that we do our mindfulness work with. So we, because of all of the trauma that started in Nashville, we had a tornado right before we went out of school for the pandemic. So we got hit double time. We know that students are going through different situations as well as parents. So to make sure that we're still building community, we start our school day every day with the school-wide morning meeting. So over 200 students on our team's call. That way we can set the stage. We go through breathing, mindfulness strategies. We have me moments that we try to just speak life into our students. So self-affirmations. And then set the expectations for the day. That way everyone school-wide has the same expectations. So we're giving our students that sense of normalcy, that sense of consistency. So when we do break off and go to our classes, we don't run into, those heartbreaking stories like Luke and Danielle's family has experienced.
Well, this member of our text club writes, I'm a high school principal. Most of our work has been focused on helping teachers use tools in Zoom to avoid or immediately extinguish disruptive behaviors. Some of these tools include filtering who you allow to join your class Zoom waiting room, limiting or disabling chat, don't allow students to unmute, and empowering teachers to remove a disruptive student from the Zoom session. We're discussing school discipline with Rachel Silberstein, an education reporter covering New York State for the Times Union, and Ricky Gibbs, the principal of Warner Arts Magnet Elementary in Nashville, Tennessee. I'm Jen White. We'll hear more from you and our guests in a moment.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Google. Google's free tools are designed to help millions of businesses around the country adapt to a new way of working. From updating their business hours to switching to curbside pickup to activating online booking, small businesses are staying connected to their customers with Google. They can even add gift card and donation links on Google so they can get support from their community. Explore Google's free tools for small businesses at google.com/grow.
Do you talk about the news with your friends, your family, or maybe perfect strangers? You can get all the facts you need to be up to speed on this busy news cycle on the 1A News Roundup. Find the podcast in your feed every Friday.
I'm Rodney Carmichael. And on this episode of Louder Than a Riot, did bias against rap lyrics seal the fate of No Limits' Mac Phipps?
This guy shouldn't be incarcerated. And I know that his music got him incarcerated, but they got the wrong guy.
Listen now to the Louder Than a Riot podcast from NPR Music.
Let's get back to our discussion of school discipline in the pandemic with Rachel Silberstein, an education reporter for the Times Union, and Ricky Gibbs, the principal of Warner Arts Magnet Elementary in Nashville, Tennessee. Principal Gibbs, you talked a little bit about what the beginning of the school day looks like for your school, but you also approach discipline in a less traditional manner. How did you reimagine that discipline issue at Warner before the pandemic hit?
Yeah, so when we look at discipline, one of the things that made us have to just reimagine our whole thought process was we sat down and had a conversation and said, if a student can't read, we teach that student how to read. If a student can't do numeracy, we teach that student how to do math. But when a student comes to school and makes an inappropriate choice or a poor choice, we use straight consequences. It wasn't a teaching approach. And as a institution of learning, we just thought to ourselves, we must do better. One of our favorite thoughts comes from Charlemagne the God when he says people are making permanent, you know, decisions based upon temporary emotions. And when we talked about our boys and girls, you know, when they're so young, they do things in the spur of the moment and not thinking about, you know, how these consequences can impact them for the rest of their life. So we decided to take a mindfulness approach to our student discipline. So but if a child is, you know, having an off day or they're just antsy, it could be because they're getting ready to take a test, something's going on at home, instead of having to come to the office, they go to our mindfulness room, our Be Well room, and they get a chance to work on how to self-regulate, how to work through their breathing, work through mindfulness approach to just get themselves calm, and then they can get back to class. And the power of this strategy is not only can teachers refer students to this space, but students learn to self-refer to that space. So it's an approach that allows students to own their emotions, because none of us can tell a student how to feel because none of us don't know the situations they're coming from. So it gives them a chance to work through that and just rethink that. Because one of the most powerful learnings that I had as a school leader was before I started this journey, I used to tell my teachers all the time, let me come to your class and de-escalate the child before it gets to a big situation. But then I thought, what's de-escalating about? And I'm gonna put it in air quotes, the most powerful person, the leader of the school, the principal, coming to talk to that one individual child. It's almost as if you as a radio host, the CEO of the company, coming to talk to you about a segment that you're doing versus the producer. Hmm. So it's one of those things those type of strategies just increase anxiety in our students and gets them into that fight or flight mentality.
So how does that work though in a virtual setting? Because I can see, you know, having that physical space a child can retreat to when they need a moment. But if kids are just at home, how do you create that space for them?
So we created, because each classroom has their own individual Teams link, our mindfulness program with Be Well has a link as well. So if it's a situation where a student is, you know, antsy or has something going on, instead of a teacher having to just kick them out of class and remove that child from learning, the teacher can just tell the child, hey, Ricky, go see Ms. Ratner and Be Well. And Ms. Ratner virtually can take them through the same breathing strategies, talk them through our mindfulness approach, get them to, you know, relax, breathe deeply, get them calm, and then get back to learning. Because ultimately, punishing students, it's like we said earlier, it's going to create a larger divide between the haves and have nots when it comes to the great equalizer of education. So our thought process is, let's refocus, help our boys and girls self-regulate, because we need them in class getting a great education.
And how has this impacted the disciplinary referrals at your school, this new approach?
Over the last 2 years, we've seen almost an 80% disciplinary referral decrease. Suspension rates has plummeted. Before we went out of school in March, we were only at a 1.5% out of school suspension rate. It's one that it has helped not only decrease student disciplinary referrals, it increased teacher morale because teachers feel supported. It's increased our ability to work with families and to get everybody on the same page about ultimately what's best for students. So we've been able to get back and pull time back and increase that time on task because our students have another avenue to deal with the trauma or different situations they have versus only having to face consequences.
Rachel, how common is this trauma-informed approach to discipline in schools?
Most administrators that I've spoken to would tell me that they've increasingly been turning to these restorative justice, more therapeutic disciplinary strategies as an alternative to suspension. But the data shows that suspensions are still used and they disproportionately impact, you know, students of color, students with disabilities, low-income students, as well as other harsher forms of school discipline. And I think in light of the pandemic, when schools are focusing more on sort of, you know, the trauma-informed therapy and, you know, the social-emotional they call its component. I think there's now advocates are seeing an opening to really push for, you know, doing away with suspensions altogether.
Well, we got this tweet from Marty who says, don't forget, lockdowns have decimated school funding in many states, so they have had less resources for training teachers and preparing for online teaching, along with increased responsibilities. This lack of preparedness is not a school failure. It's a failure in funding. And Principal Gibbs, I think you mentioned the Be Well program at your school. You're able to do this work through a partnership, but talk about the funding piece of this.
Yeah, so we've been blessed because we received a grant from the Tennessee Department of Education that helped us fund the position for the last 2 years. But as we move into next school year, it's going to become a budget item on our local budget. So coming straight from the school's budget. But it's one of those that as we talk about priorities, it's one that we have to continue to prioritize our students' well-being, because if we don't think about their social emotional well-being, they'll never get to the academics, because if they're not able to stay in class, they're not able to learn. So when we talk about the funding, it's going to come from the local budget starting next school year. But I will say we've been blessed with a state grant to pay for it the last 2 years.
Well, Rachel, we've been talking a lot about what virtual classrooms are like. What about schools that are doing in-person learning? How has discipline changed there?
I think it's still early in the year to have a good data set to say how that's working out. But I do know that there is a strong push for less severe forms of discipline, given that, you know, kids have been out of school for 6 months and have endured all this trauma. We're seeing, like I said earlier, a push to do a moratorium on school suspension, to get police out of classrooms, and, other sort of strategies to, create a more holistic educational environment.
Well, we have a lot more to talk about with Rachel Silberstein, education reporter for the Times Union, and Ricky Gibbs, principal of Warner Arts Magnet Elementary, and we'll do just that right after a short break. This is 1A from WAMU and NPR.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Swell. Swell is a place for thoughtful audio conversations that are unlike anything you've experienced. Interact with authors, celebrity chefs, teachers, artists, CEOs, or connect with new people from all over the world. Listen on Swell for fresh ideas and perspectives. And once you're comfortable with the app, start a new conversation by posting a Swell of your own. Swell is free in the App Store and on Google Play. From technologists to podcasters, interesting people are talking on Swell.
Voting is crucial, and I don't give a damn how you look at it.
Is this America?
It was we, the people.
The land of the free and the home of the brave.
Not we, the white male citizens.
Misrepresentative Democracy.
A new series about voting in America from NPR's Throughline.
Episodes drop October 15th.
This is 1A, and we're continuing our conversation about how schools and teachers are navigating discipline in the time of virtual learning. And we got this message from a teacher who says, I haven't had to remove a student, but I do use the mute button a lot. I think it helps that the parents are there, and my co-teacher and I have a schedule that has lots of offline learning time for kids to move away from their screens. Another teacher texts, I've had an incident where two students were having an inappropriate chat related to our class discussion. I had to tell them I needed to see them after class. We had a chat about the importance of how we do online discussions. They listened, and we haven't had problems since. Principal Gibbs, how much teacher training centers around this issue of classroom management?
The bulk of teacher training needs to be centered around it, because ultimately one of the things that I tell all of our educators here at our school is you can plan for an amazing lesson, but if you don't have the strategies in place to successfully manage your classroom, be it in person or virtually, and students are not engaged because they're distracted, nothing that you've planned will matter. So when we talk about, especially in the virtual setting, we spent a lot of time on the front end about, hey, let's talk through expectations. What are reasonable expectations? You know, something as early I heard someone talk about, well, a child couldn't eat. Well, you know, we can't really dictate if the babies are at home, what time they're eating. And that might be the only chance that child has to eat that day. So we really have to make sure that we're mindful of our approach on that. So when it comes, especially this virtual setting, it's taking a lot of front end training to just not only talk about what expectations that you want to have inside your classroom, but needs to be school wide. But then also, you know, what's a reasonable accommodation to make sure that we're working hand in hand, because ultimately one of the biggest blessings that we've seen in the virtual setting is the partnership that we're creating a deeper partnership with parents. And that's something that was unexpected, but greatly appreciated in this virtual setting.
I want to play a clip from a podcast from Nashville Public Radio called The Promise. And this season follows the journey to diversify the most educationally segregated neighborhood in Nashville.
How is the school year going?
Well, for my behavior, awesome.
He's making nearly all A's. He isn't acting out as much. He's been getting into yoga and the daily breathing exercises.
So on the count of three, I want you to take a deep breath in. Let it out.
The step principal Gibbs brought in as part of his turnaround plan, which he also leads himself over the loudspeaker twice a day.
Give yourself one more hug.
And Dr. Hughes just knows how to talk to BJ.
It's not acceptable. I love you to death. Yes, I do. But I'm not going to allow you to sit in my class and disrespect me. You're not doing that. You're not. You're better than that.
Principal Gibbs, and first thanks to Mariba Knight, who produced that podcast, and for letting us use that clip. But Principal, walk us through some of the voices we heard there. What can you tell us about BJ and students like him?
So BJ is one of the stories that we like to talk about, just how the impact of a great education can happen. He, from his kindergarten to his third grade year, he was a student that probably was suspended over 20 times. Really, really smart, really, really smart student. But he sometimes struggles with impulse control. So as we've talked about reimagining school, reimagining school discipline, we wanted to make sure that all of our boys and girls were able to have success. And he's one of the students that had the most success, because when he did something that would traditionally get him an office referral or had him suspended from school, instead of coming to the office and, you know, have that heightened energy because he has to talk to the principal, he got a chance to talk to our Be Well teacher and talk about things that were happening at home, got a chance to calm himself down. And once he did that, he was ready to get back in class. And if you just hear him, you hear him speak, the things that he speaks about are things that most fourth graders never would think about. But the first, you know, kindergarten through third grade years, he didn't get a chance to display those characteristics because he was always in the office. Hmm. So that's just one of those things that we were able to do.
Rachel, you mentioned this push to ban suspensions in K-12 schools during the pandemic in New York, where you're reporting. Has this proposal to put suspensions on hold been met by any resistance?
I think there's always a bit of resistance and bureaucracy when it comes to limiting sort of the tools that teachers have to manage the classroom. Of course, there's like unions and government that can stand in the way. But this coalition's been pushing for, you know, caps on suspension and time out of school for some time. And they're just seeing sort of the pandemic as an opportunity to set like more concrete limits and do it sort of from a sort of executive level instead of a legislative level.
And who do they think this ban will best help?
Well, especially, of course, the kids who are disproportionately impacted by these disciplinary measures. And you have to remember that during the pandemic, it was such a Herculean effort just to get students online to begin with. And the students that there were kids, particularly students in low-income homes or students of color or with disabilities who never really logged on at all in the spring when schools first closed. And so really, I think they're asking educators to ask themselves, like, what benefit is there to keeping kids out of school at all when it was, you know, so challenging to get them into the classroom and online in the first place?
Principal Gibbs, we only have about 30 seconds here, but quickly, where's the opportunity in this moment as you see it as an educator?
This is the opportunity for us to reimagine education in itself, thinking about resources and strategies that we can continue to use to expose our boys and girls for the future. It's about looking past today's present and preparing for tomorrow's future. So I'm excited about what's in store for us and what we can do next to continue to change lives through the power of a great education.
That's Ricky Gibbs. He's the principal of Warner Arts Magnet Elementary in Nashville, Tennessee, and Rachel Silberstein, an education reporter for the Times Union. Thanks to you both. And remember, we're on Instagram. Follow us at The 1A Show. This conversation was produced by Emmanuel Johnson, and our podcast is produced by Matthew Simonson. To learn more about them and the rest of the team, visit the1a.org. This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. I'm Jen White. Thanks so much for listening, and let's talk again tomorrow. This is 1A.